Welcome to Four Color Film, a podcast about movies that leapt off the screen and into your comic collection. Here is your host, Dennis Calero.
In 1991, a master filmmaker and a master comic book artist sank their teeth into one of the most iconic characters in literary history. This is the story of the comic book adaptation of 1992's Bram Stoker's Dracula. ...1992's adaptation of Bram Stoker's classic novel, Dracula, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, is one of those rare movies that did well at the box office, but then proceeded to also become a cult classic. The movie is a sumptuous feast of color and effects, costumes, and performance that create an experience that is, at once, both deadly serious and decidedly camp. If you're like me, and you've watched a lot of Dracula movies, you know that strangely, there are often bizarre changes to the text. By contrast, the 1992 film follows the original novel somewhat, capturing the gothic atmosphere and dread of the original story. Famously, Coppola decided to stick with in-camera special effects. There's only one optical shot in the film, the rest being done in-camera. There's an amazing shot where a train is crossing a horizon lit by the sunset, and the eyes of Dracula looming in the background like some twisted god, with Jonathan Harker's journal in the foreground, which is actually a giant book in front of an actual model of a train with a rear projection of Gary Oldman's eyes in the background. The movie itself is a bizarre delight. Topps Comics was a comic book publishing company founded in 1993, a collectibles company best known for producing trading cards. Topps Comics was initially focused on licensed properties. It also published original works by popular comic book writers and illustrators such as Jim Lee, Kurt Busiek, and Warren Ellis. The book was written by Roy Thomas, a legendary comics writer and editor who has worked in the industry since 1965. He is most well known for his work on Marvel Comics, having served as editor-in-chief from 1972 to 74, and writing for titles such as The Avengers, Conan, X-Men, and The Invaders. Born in Jackson, Mississippi in 1940, Thomas was an avid reader of comics from a young age. He began his career at Marvel Comics in 1965, writing for titles such as The Avengers, X-Men, and The Fantastic Four. As editor-in-chief, he oversaw the publication of some of the most iconic stories in comics. In addition to his work at Marvel Comics, Thomas has written for other publishers, including DC Comics, and worked as an editor and a publisher. He is co-creator of the character Red Sonja, and has been inducted into the Will Eisner Comic Book Hall of Fame. Thomas has continued to write and edit comics into the 21st century, and is widely considered one of the most influential figures in the history of the medium. Mike Mignola is a renowned artist and writer of comic books, best known for creating the character of Hellboy, the story of which has been adapted into three feature films and a variety of other media. Mignola's career began in the 1980s when he was hired to illustrate for Marvel Comics' The Incredible Hulk and other titles, including a significant stint drawing future MCU superstar Rocket Raccoon. He went on to draw and write for various other publishers, including DC, Dark Horse, and Image. Mignola is most celebrated for his creation of the character Hellboy, which first appeared in 1994 and has since become a major franchise. Mignola's artwork is known for its dark, gothic style and is heavily influenced by his love of horror and fantasy. He is also renowned for his use of shadow and light and his ability to create an atmosphere of mood and suspense. On a side note, I once asked Mike if during the evolution of his art, had an editor ever stopped him and asked him what was going on? It wasn't meant as an insult, and it wasn't taken as such. Mike answered my question by saying when he was drawing a book for DC, he decided to make one character a giant, not for any narrative reason, but because it seemed fun and cool. The editor asked him if that was what he wanted to do, and Mike said yes, and that was it. The editor in question wisely chose to stay out of the way. In the period between the mid-80s and early 90s, Mignola's work became more spare, simplified, and direct. That's not to say I don't love his early work, because I do. Triumph and Torment, the graphic novel that pairs Doctor Strange with Doctor Doom on a mission to save Doom's mother from the clutches of Mephisto, who is basically the devil, is an absolute masterclass of drawing and embellishment. It was this Mignola that came to the project in the early 90s, when Francis Ford Coppola decided his next movie was going to be Dracula. Not a remake of the 1931 movie, but a film that would go more or less back to the original novel. The 1992 graphic novel adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula was generally well received by critics. Many praised the artwork, noting how well it captured the dark, gothic atmosphere of the film. Others appreciated the faithfulness to the movie's plot, while still highlighting the few key differences that make the graphic novel unique. Topps even printed a rare red foil cover, which could be won by a mail-in contest. In interviews, both Mignola and Thomas have spoken highly of the book. Thomas has said that he wanted to stay as faithful to the film as possible, while still making the graphic novel feel like its own entity. Mignola has talked about how he tried to create illustrations that captured the mood and atmosphere of the movie, while also letting his own style come through. The graphic novel adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula was released shortly after the film itself. The graphic novel is an excellent companion to the movie, capturing much of its dark, haunting atmosphere. Jim Salakrup is the editor-in-chief at Papercuts, publishers of Nancy Drew, The Hardy Boys, Tales from the Crypt, and The Smurfs. He is also a trustee at the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art, and Jim was kind enough to join us to talk about Dracula.
They had just started Topps Comics as a part of the Topps Company, which is famous for bazooka bubblegum, trading cards, sports and non-sports trading cards, ring pops, on and on. It was their vice president of new product development, a wonderful guy named Ira Friedman, who was looking into other possibilities to expand the company. They hadn't been doing comics. And they had, as one of their creative directors, a guy named Len Brown, who was a huge comics fan. At one time, he was Roy Thomas's roommate in their early days in New York. He worked for Wally Wood, and Wally Wood named Dynamo his secret identity. It's Leonard Brown after good old Lenny at Topps. And he's a huge comics fan. I think they may have even hired a consultant. In this case, it was Mike Friedrich to find what would be possible compatible businesses that Topps could enter into. And of course, comics was his suggestion. And Ira had noticed also that they've been doing, because he was heading up also the non-sports trading cards, the entertainment cards they call them. Right. And so they would be getting these licenses to a lot of properties that comic book companies would also get the license to do comics on. He thought, well, you know, the cards and the comics, are a lot of them are sold in the same stores. So why couldn't Topps be able to do both? And his particular concept was that these comics could be bagged with cards.
Right.
It would be both. So I believe probably in the normal course of things, Dracula would have been the next trading card series Ira would have been putting together. So naturally, that's the one he figured, well, let's see if we could do comic books based on it. And, even before I got there, they were planning this stuff. And so, as much as I love to take credit for everything, I have to give credit where it's due. So Len Brown, I think when Ira, who's not necessarily a huge comics fan compared to, say, Len Brown, would ask for his advice and input, he thought, based on Mike's work on Gotham by Gaslight, that Batman series,
Elseworlds,
that Mike would be a perfect guy to do Francis Ford's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Makes perfect sense.
And he was completely right about that. Len also having that connection with Roy Thomas, Roy, who who loves to do adaptations, you know, was, you know, happy to work, you know, on it. Roy will, as quite often said, his favorite collaborators are dead authors. But in this case, although Bram Stoker was dead or undead, there was, you know, people alive working on the movie. And to just back up on some of those, Mike Mignola, you know, like you, was a big Dracula fan. And he was hoping that one day he'd get to do a fairly faithful adaptation of Dracula. Roy actually, had started and then eventually completed a faithful adaptation of Dracula with artist Dick Giordano.
Right.
So, this was a different thing. You know, he was adapting, I believe the script for the movie was by Jim Hart.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very cooperative in helping make this adaptation. And Francis himself, his connection, when he was young, he was a camp counselor. And one of the stories he loved to read to the kids around the campfire was Bram Stoker's Dracula. So his goal was to, you know, try to do an old style, you know, movie. I think he was happier with how the comic book came out than he was with the final film, explaining everyone he would talk to out in Hollywood. His concern was most Hollywood movies look alike.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he talked to the costume person or the set decker, the cinematographer, all the way down the line, he was explaining he had this concept to make this as a low tech,
right,
sort of no CGI, all the effects and, you know, in the camera.
In camera.
And yeah, like, and have it feel like it was made maybe 100 years ago or something. And and everyone he spoke to, they said, oh, Francis, because, you know, that's Hollywood. Oh, we get it. We understand what you're saying. We'll do exactly that. And as Francis lamented, everyone proceeded to do exactly what they would do on any other big budget Hollywood film, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, it's hard to break out of those habits when you're in a particular system. So it got to the point where I was hired by Topps to be the editor-in-chief. I think, again, Roy Thomas, one of the guys who hired me originally at Marvel Comics in 1972, had heard, you know, I had left Marvel in 92. He suggested to Len and Ira that they consider me as their editor of their comics group, and they hired me. And this was the first project which sort of fell into my lap. And again, as I said, as much as I like to take credit for stuff, so much was underway already,
right,
that mostly what I had to do was just try to stay out of the way. But it was really exciting. Roy was, you know, happy to be involved with it. I think Mike treated the Roy's script as a guide. I think he...
As we are wont to do.
He was deciding his own pacing, what would work best, which was fine. One of the things for comic book adaptations, and it varies from project to project, depending on how many, you know, what kind of rights publisher is able to obtain, was that Mike had to do some likenesses, you know, some sample,
sure,
likenesses of a lot of the main characters. Because those actors had approval rights in their contracts.
Right.
You know, Mike is excellent. He did great jobs on everyone, and everyone was excited. Oh, what a fun thing. I'm going to be in a comic book, except for Winona Ryder. And I think, ironically, it was because at the time, She was dating some guy who had a tattoo that said Winona Forever on him. And he was advising her, Mr. Johnny Depp, that, if you're going to be successful, serious actress, you got to watch all this merchandising stuff. And Mike was able to do sketches that she ultimately approved of. And if you look in the adaptation, you'll find probably a little less of her than you would in the movie. You know, we tried to...
That'll show her.
Well, not so much that, but...
I kid, of course.
Just to avoid the...
The hassle.
Well, it could hold the whole thing up. And, you know, a lot of these movie adaptations, even though this was a serialized one, you want to take advantage of the, you know, the movie studio spending millions and millions of dollars promoting the film.
Right, free advertising for you.
Comes out, before anyone knows whether it's good or not. You know, perhaps the classic example of that goes back to Roy again. Star Wars, also serialized, came out months before the movie did. Very few people remember that. And it's almost as if, in a weird way, Star Wars was the first Marvel movie. Because
that's certainly one way to look at it, yeah.
Well, there was an audience that had been reading the Marvel comic. And, you know, hearing about it, and they were thrilled to see it. With Dracula, we wanted to get it out as early as we could, you know, to take advantage of that. And so we didn't want any of those crazy holdups. The other interesting factor about Dracula was typical for Coppola. He was struggling. I mean, this is a movie based on a classic. It's been made into movies before, et cetera, et cetera. Leave it to Francis to be struggling for the ending. there's endings. You know, don't worry. But, you know, he throws himself completely into his filmmaking. He's a true artist. He was... interestingly, very involved with the creation of the comic.
How did that work exactly? Was it just phone calls, faxes? How did that, you know, logistically?
Yeah, mostly, it was in the pre-Zoom age, where mostly phone calls and faxes and us dealing with his office out at, I think there was still Zoetrope Studios back then. You know, I think his son, who was a was an assistant director or something on the movie, was also very much involved a knowledgeable comics fan. And in a weird way, Francis was perhaps a little bit, Jim Hart was also involved looking at everything. I think he was probably more satisfied with how the comic was coming along, even though at that stage the movie wasn't complete. So we were adapting something, you know, from Hart's screenplay, but that didn't necessarily mean that's what the movie would be. So
when you were adapting it, just to your point earlier, did you have the ending, or was that still in flux?
There was a complete script. And Roy had that, and Roy based his script on that. Once the script's done first, and then they start shooting, it's a wonderful story if you haven't heard it before. But, as I said, Francis was, working on the movie, and he was, like, perhaps second-guessing himself and trying to figure out the best way to do it. And since he was enjoying the comics adaptation and seemed to really like what Mike was doing, he thought, well, why don't I invite Mike in? Mike was sort of like dumbstruck by this. And in a rare moment of Mike asking me for advice, called me. You know, it didn't know how to react. And we're both assuming this is going to be a screening with maybe 20 of the studio employees and all that, and maybe a little Q&A at the end.
A courtesy.
And who knows? But... My advice was based on, these Hollywood people and how Francis is very much not like that. I said, if he's asking you to be there, it's entirely because he respects your work. You know, what a great job you're doing here. So, Mike, if you know him, is a man with intelligent opinions. And I told him, don't hold back. Don't be beholding to them. Don't feel you have to like yes them and all that. You know, if they ask for your opinion, give it to them. And he sort of like agreed. So he goes to the screening, and like he called me like maybe the next day or something, because it was kind of unbelievable to him. There were only three people at the screening. One was Francis, one was Mike, and the other was George Lucas.
Wow.
So, and, you know, and he's asking them for their opinions. So it's almost like George and Mike are being cast in the consigliere. No, what is it? With Francis being, you know, Brando and
right.
the Godfather, letting his counsel sort of debate it. And, you know, there's Mike, as far as I know, hadn't made any movies yet, debating with George Lucas and Francis listening in. And who knows how much Francis took from that or who he listened to, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. But just, you know, what a surreal experience that is. You know, Mike was like, I'm arguing with George Lucas about, you know, how to make a movie. I think the specific thing that Mike did that's definitely in the movie is he designed Dracula's castle that's used. In the,
oh, cool. You know,
that's very much a Mignola looking castle,
oh,
et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera. But, you know, we were able to do it. And Mike was very heavily involved every step of the way. I have to give him a lot of credit. You know, Mike's style was actually in the process of evolving at that point.
Yes.
Where he had those little zigzaggy feathering technique,
mm-hmm.
Which was not very common in comics. And I think when Nyberg got pencils at first, he just assumed that was an indication of where to put the feathering. And I think Mike was able to have a conversation with him. meet in person, very friendly.
Of course, just saying, of course. Oh, no, just clarification.
Yeah, let me show you what I'm actually trying to go for here. You know, I really do want those little, you know, zigzaggy lines. We didn't have any problems other than what I mentioned as far as approvals were concerned. You know, like, no, nothing had to be changed. Nothing had to be rewritten. One thing I have to add, because this was sort of the debut of Topps Comics, publisher Ira Friedman personally was sort of handling the publicity for the comic, and he was phenomenal. I don't think I have ever worked with anyone who worked so hard and was so successful at promoting a particular comic. It was kind of weird to put that much energy and work into something that ultimately was just four issues, you know, but he was into making sure horror magazines knew about it, you know, getting promotion, well, every possible place he
That's
could.
Terrific.
And so when that came out, what a way to make a debut as a new comics company where everyone knows, you know, the comic you're publishing. This book had to be a labor of love for Mike, you know, but, you know, he had that kind of desire that he wanted to do this Dracula project. And when he and the other creators were very much involved in every step of it, you know, my thing was just to, you know, accommodate them as best I could and realize how lucky I was.
Hello and welcome to the roundtable discussion of our podcast. The video will be available on YouTube. The video will contain images from the book in question. I have with me here Steve Hovicki, who is the co-founder of Printed in Blood and the host of the Sentimental podcast. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Dennis. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
So, as you know, we are discussing what is properly pronounced as Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Unless you're Anthony Hopkins and it's Dracula.
The film released in the early 90s. And our focus today. We'll talk about the film a little bit, because I'm sure you have your point of view on the film. But we're going to focus today on the graphic comic book adaptation, which is somewhat graphic, by Roy Thomas and Mike Mignola. And as I'm an artist, I'm probably going to be fair, I'm probably going to speak to the art more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Let's start by just, Steve, I'm going to just ask you, what do you think of the movie in general?
You know, it's funny, when I recently reread the graphic novel, when you had asked me to jump on this with you, and I'll be honest, I don't think I've seen it start to finish since it came out. You know, I know the Dracula, I know the Bram Stoker Dracula story. And so when I reread this, there was a lot that I had actually kind of forgotten about. And in my own research about the comic itself, I feel that it's structurally pretty accurate to what I remember from the novel. So rereading it was fun, because it was really fun to revisit. The visuals obviously are very well known, and there's no point in the reading of the graphic novel where I couldn't picture everyone and, you know, all the actors in place anyway. So it was fun. It was literally like revisiting the film while reading this.
Yeah, I think actually in some ways, because I do revisit the film probably, you know, every Halloween or around that you know, period of time. This was a seminal film for me. I was in college, or just coming out of college. Mike was also an artist very much in flux.
The thing with Mike's work, and this is from evolutionary speaking, just over the years, you know, I was a tremendous fan of Cosmic Odyssey. It's really fun to see his work with finishes by other inkers.
Right.
When he's not doing his own finishes, I always find it fun to see how much more stuff is added, because I know his pencils pretty well, and I remember his older stuff, and I've seen older pencils of his, and he was a little more detailed. And he just gradually found that spot, that, you know, that look that he's so well known for. And it's always interesting to me. That's why I was interested when I saw the beginning of this, that the inks were done by John Nyberg, and it still comes off looking very much like Mike. I think John did an excellent job capturing the way that Mike, and that might have been a conversation they had.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. I believe Jim actually mentioned that there was a conversation more often than not there is within an art team about how they're going to approach. And I believe the colors were by Mike Chiarello, and he of course is an amazing, as well as being a classic art director of DC fame, is an amazing artist in his own right and a great colorist. Mike's evolution has always been very interesting to me, in particular because he began sort of as a fairly traditional comic book artist of the mid to late 80s. And I wouldn't say anything really to me stood super out. He did some fun stuff. I think the first thing that kind of hit my attention in terms of his evolution as an artist is probably his work on Rocket Raccoon.
Okay.
Which I think he began to distort, you know, the human form and the rocket, the raccoon form, extremely. And it was really shortly after that we got things like World of Krypton, where he, you know, he would have, like, you know, people were 14-foot giants and you know, just really expressive uses of shadow. Also, you began to see, whereas you see in this image from World of Krypton, there's still a lot of sort of rendering and sort of linear rendering. Whereas when you get to Cosmic Odyssey and Dracula, that's almost completely gone. It's really all, you know, 90% black and white with a minimum bit of rendering. And he almost becomes, and I certainly don't mean to make this sound in any way pejorative, but he almost becomes more of a designer than a pure, you know, he's not interested in showing you that he knows how to draw a face or a hand super accurately, super naturalistically or photorealistically. He wants to hit you with the idea of a hand, or hit you
the strength of an image,
with the strength of the entire image. And he had a lot to work with.
And you know what's funny? I was noticing in the early, especially in the early pages of that first issue, It was really interesting to me to see how well he nailed likeness with so few lines and details. I mean, literally just with structure and shape and a couple of highlight lines, he was really able, especially in the first issue of the 4-issue mini, the shots of Mina, Winona Ryder. There's a couple of shots in there that it's stunning how close he nailed her face with like three or four lines, you know, and just the tiniest bit of shadow. His Anthony Hopkins rendering is great. His Gary Oldman look is good. And I don't know if it's because I know the imagery so well that I'm able to extrapolate that in my own brain and look at it and kind of overlay automatically. I just feel like that some of this stuff is he's really great at it. And I don't think he gets that recognition because he does so much original stuff, and most of his work is based on stuff that either he's creating himself or not necessarily pulled from a person that people know. I think that his ability to do that with so few details is really amazing.
I mean, the late great John Paul Leon, who was of course a brilliant artist in his own right, he once told me that he thought of Mignola's stuff as like surgery, like just so incredibly precise. The ability to break down reality into a precise set of lines and tones is, you know, such an incredible skill in its own right. To give the movie its due, the movie is incredibly well designed, from costumes to set design.
And in the afterword in the graphic novel by the screenwriter Jim Hart, he mentions that Francis and Mike were very much in communication during the production.
Coppola has always been a director that was very into, you know, he has Steranko do a bunch of designs. Jim Steranko do a bunch of designs for this movie. He's for all accounts a comic book fan. Him and George Lucas is an avid fan of American illustration. Is going to be opening his own museum of the stuff. The costume design's gorgeous. The background design is gorgeous. So, and the images that Mike gets to draw of Dracula in the red blood red armor, muscle armor.
Yeah,
the physical armor is an incredible piece of work on its own. So,
oh sure,
to be able to literally and metaphorically draw from that is great, because you can't. It would be difficult to make it look not interesting.
So going through this, there were a couple of panels that stood out to me. There's one very early on that really set the tone for me when Jonathan Harker first arrives to get picked up at Borgo Pass. And it's the bottom of a page on the left side, and he's standing there next to a sort of little hooded, almost like a signpost kind of thing. And the carriage is kind of moving away on the right side.
I remember the panel. Yeah.
And that to me just absolutely leapt off the page, just setting the tone for the whole thing for me. I just kind of stopped and looked at it for a minute, because his ability again to give you everything you need with an absolute minimum of actual line work and art just is amazing. And here's one I had a question about. Maybe you can answer this a little better for me. As I was going through this again, there were obviously very iconic stills and scenes from the film that stand out and that are represented here in the book very nicely. But overall, as you went through this, and again, this is a question because you've seen this more recently than I, how much of it, when you look through this, do you think was really pulled from actual scenes of the film? Because if he was involved so much at the early stages of not only design work, but productions and that kind of thing, I find it fascinating to see was he drawing this like literally as they were making the film?
The book was being illustrated, or at least during the film, or at least as the film was winding down. And I'm sure he had access to, you know, obviously many images from the film. But I find it very interesting, because most comic book adaptations of this time, or really to this day, and I would handle this the same way as an artist, there are at least a few images that are taken directly from the film. Thinking about the wonderful adaptation of Empire Strikes Back by Al Williamson, where it's a beautiful illustration, but and it's not a but, it's just he chose to represent at least certain images directly lifted from stills, you know, drawn, reinterpreting it in his style. But I don't think, to be honest, having seen the movie recently and then looked through the comic book, I doubt that there's a single image in the book that's directly lifted from a still or from a frame from the movie. These to me seem like reinvented illustrations. Like he took the film, the set designs, the costume designs, the characters, the likenesses, and then said, okay, got it. It would have been interesting to talk to someone who reads the book and has never seen the film and then watch the film and see what their interpretation might be. But I think what you're saying, and I agree with it, is that this is really one of those cases, which is really why I wanted to do this podcast in the first place. It's one of those rare cases where I feel the comic book is almost a more pure apotheosis of the story, even more than the film is. Like the film, almost to say is that we often, because obviously film is the art medium of the 20th and 21st century. It's the medium of art that most pervades people's lives, except for maybe music. But having said that, to me, it's almost like the movie existed just so that the comic book could then be done.
Thank you to Steve and Jim. Be sure to check out their links, as well as links to the books, references, and videos we discussed in this podcast. And of course, thanks to Venganza Media.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Four Color Film, hosted by Dennis Calero. Four Color Film is produced by Arnie Carvalho. Credits read by Brock. The opinions expressed on Four Color Film are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated. Four Color Film is an independent podcast and not affiliated with any company that created the film or comic discussed in this episode. Four Color Film is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2023, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced or repurposed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.